Hey, what's going on, Champagne Sharks? This is a second episode with P.E. Moskowitz, and it's a continuation of the last one. You don't have to listen to the last one to understand this one, but it's worth listening to anyway because it's pretty good. The last one was about their book, The Case for Free Speech, and the current book is How to Kill a City, which is about gentrification. And we have Mario. This time, Mario's in from the beginning.
Hello.
No surprises.
Right? Hey, everybody. It's Mario. You can catch me on Twitter at MDMills79. Good to be here.
And we have with us Kenny.
What up, yo? It's Kenny. You can't find me anywhere because I don't exist anywhere except for on the podcast. So now, how you like that?
Oh, man.
Yeah. That's a very existential question.
Existential as hell, man.
Yeah, yeah. If you're not social media nowadays, do you exist?
Do you exist at all? Yeah.
I'm just a vessel. And P.E., if you can introduce yourself.
Yeah. I'm P.E. Moskowitz, author, journalist. You can find me on Twitter, _PEM_PEM.
Okay. And I think I want to start with you giving an overview of the book and what it's about. And then I think all three of us live in different places with different issues with gentrification. And the good thing about your book is it covers multiple cities. So there is something about everybody's city in it. So if you can just give an overview of the book.
Yeah. So, you know, same with the first book we talked about, The Case Against Free Speech, like the How to Kill a City started with kind of me wanting to go beyond the current discourse we were having about a topic, in this case, gentrification. Because I don't know if you remember, like back in 2012, which is when I started writing that book, you know, it was the kind of like, there was like an epidemic of articles of hipsters are moving in and opening nice coffee shops. And is this going to revitalize the neighborhood and those kinds of things. And the kind of a caricature of a, you know, white guy with a mustache and who rides a weird bike and all that kind of stuff. You know, meanwhile, me and all my friends were being priced out of New York where I grew up. People were being priced out of their cities all over. I was seeing all this terrible shit going on all across the country. And no one was really talking about it in a way that was about like the systemic side of things, like how it's actually happening. The book was kind of my attempt to say, or to figure out like what is gentrification actually about? Is it about just people moving into cities and being hip or whatever? Or is there something deeper going on? And, you know, obviously I found there's something much deeper going on, which is like a purposeful attempt by politicians and the real estate class to essentially turn cities into money making machines at the expense of poor people and people of color. And yeah, in order to figure that out, I spent time in New Orleans, where I live now, Detroit, New York, and San Francisco. And each of those cities kind of represent different ways that things gentrify and also different phases of gentrification. But the lessons from each city, I think, are applicable to any American city right now, because every single city is going through the exact same thing where everything is being bought up and people are being kicked out and politicians are doing absolutely nothing about it.
So what was kind of I hear three different stories about this, like with the mecca of gentrification, like where it all began. Like some say New York, others say San Francisco. I wouldn't say Los Angeles because it's just been hitting hardest out here, like within the last 15 years or so. I guess I'll throw Portland up there too, but like in your research for the book, is there any particular point of origin that you would say this kind of began?
Yeah, I would say it's New York, just in terms of how far back the planning of gentrification goes. And I think that's something people don't realize, is like gentrification is not just some random thing where all of a sudden cities are twice as expensive as they used to be. It's right. Like a planned political and money-making strategy. And you know, way back in the early 1900s, New York politicians and bankers in New York got together and kind of saw the future. You know, they saw industrial jobs moving down south and then overseas. They saw that the U.S. economy was going to become a more consumerist economy and less of a manufacturing economy. And they basically came up with this plan to gentrify New York way back in the early 1900s, that, you know, they would rezone large swaths of Manhattan Manhattan from industrial into high-end residential, what that would do was, one, force people out to the outer boroughs where real estate developers could then get profit from, you know, leasing or selling land for the factories that used to exist in Manhattan. And then two, they could take the land that was in Manhattan and luxury developments on them and, you know, so kind of doubly profit. So you fast forward to the 1960s, you know, I forget the exact numbers now, but the 1960s is when kind of everything in the U.S. was deindustrializing and factories were moving overseas and everything. But during that period, the New York was losing industrial jobs six times faster than anywhere else. That's because New York had been strategically planning for that for the last 100 years. So yeah, I mean, I think in terms of effective gentrification, like, it's a toss-up. New York started gentrifying really badly in the 70s and then the 80s. So did San Francisco and a bunch of other cities. But in terms of just the planning for gentrification to actually happen, I think New York takes the cake.
Yeah, that really shocked me when I saw that, because like me, you're a native New Yorker. And there's a lot of things that I kind of took for granted. Like, for example, the idea of a business improvement district or a BID, I never quite realized how nefarious it can be until I read your book. I've just always seen them around. I just thought they were just little offices in every neighborhood that just, you know, try to, almost like a community board, but like a private community board that just tries to fix up and beautify a neighborhood and help things out. Like, I didn't really realize what a weapon of development and renewal and social policy, like consumerist social policy, like they are. They're pretty crazy. They have like no real accountability to much of anybody, right?
No, and I mean, their purpose is to kind of push real estate prices up and to make businesses as much money as possible. You know, from a business perspective, gentrification is always good for two reasons. One, the more money that exists in a city, the more money that, you know, corporations and business owners get. But on the more nefarious side of things, the fewer poor people exist in a city, the fewer services are required to provide for them. So I think a good analogy is like how highways were built in the 1940s, like interstate highways. They would literally calculate where to put highways by saying, where are the poorest people who take tax revenue from the city, and then ram a highway through there, because that would essentially force everyone in that area to leave and go somewhere else. And I think gentrification works in the kind of the same way. It's, you know, if you look at New York now, to me, it's a completely dead city. But on the books, everything's going great because there's more money, there's more tax revenue, and there are fewer people who need things like public housing, public transit, and all the rest. All of that can be privatized. And the cities now have less responsibility to actually provide anything for people.
And meanwhile, the homeless population has basically become like a backdrop to the landscape of the city. Like, it's just a part of it. People have just come to accept it as it's a part. I don't even think I don't even know if people look at it as necessary evil. I just think people just accept it as, you know, part of how it is. Like, it's the new normal for a lot of people, man.
I feel like at least in New York, we see less of them now. I don't know where they're putting them, but
I mean, they're paying for them to be put in other cities as far away as like Florida and stuff.
Yeah, I remember I talked about that in the episode I did on the homeless situation in Los Angeles. They were doing that. They were giving homeless people Greyhound tickets in Las Vegas. And they would give them Greyhound tickets and ship them en masse up to downtown Los Angeles and as far north as San Francisco. So, you know, there's this thing where they were also doing this thing called patient dumping, where people that had mental issues that were, you know, hospitalized or what was the term? I forget what the term for it called, placed on a hold or whatever like that. They would literally just drop them off wherever homeless people congregate, whether it be Skid Row or wherever it is in Portland, wherever it is in San Francisco. They would just drop all of these mentally ill patients off, sometimes still with gowns on and everything, and just leave them there. Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, all these problems of cities that we now think are getting better are actually just being pushed around to other places. So, like, if you look at, you know, like, New York will always say, oh, well, crime has gone down to historic lows. And if you believe that crime is, you know, a consequence of poverty, like I do, you know, people need to do illegal things in order to survive, then it's not that crime has gone down. It's just been pushed to where there are poorer people now. So if you look at random towns in Pennsylvania, the town my dad grew up in, Port Jervis, New York, you know, which I've been to a bunch of times. Now that's where all the same issues exist. That's where all the drug addiction is. That's where all the poverty is.
Long Island has a bunch of gang warfare now.
Right. So New York can say, look, we've pushed down crime. Really, what they've done is just push it out to the suburbs and exurbs of the city.
Same thing in Los Angeles. They pushed everything out of L.A., pushed it out into Lancaster and San Bernardino County. And so, you know, while there's still crime and, you know, gang activity, it's nowhere near what it was in the 80s and 90s, you know. So, and it's all going on now in these faraway regions in the desert. You know, it's just crazy.
That reminds me of that. There was an episode on The Wire where they pushed all the drug dealers to the area of Baltimore where all the vacant buildings were.
Yep.
Amsterdam.
It's all a shell game, man. It's one big shell game. So I wanted to ask you this because the premise of the book is, or at least one of the subtitles that you said is How to Kill a City. Is that what it is? I had this thing happen. I came to this realization that because I do a lot of work in my city within our school district. And lately there's been this rash of closings that have happened with some of the elementary and middle schools. And one of the things that I noticed is that when they get ready to shut these schools down, they started with start diverting services from those schools to other locations, right? So they don't get specific services that they need to take care of. Say, for example, their special education population of students that they have where they need services and things like that. They'll stop sending aides over there to help those students. They'll say, oh, you know, due to budget constraints, we can't send anyone there. They even stop the landscaping services. They'll say, you know, due to budget constraints, we can't provide the adequate landscaping services. And so, for example, one of these schools that just got shut down, Wilson Middle School, it's on this really nice street, right, called Del Mar Avenue. Del Mar is really a nice stretch in Pasadena. And then as you're driving through, you just see this eyesore because they stopped painting the school. They stopped, cutting the grass. They stopped all this stuff. So it really looks like an eyesore. And then they kind of started cutting off services. So when it came time to vote, people were not as upset about it closing down because the public perception of it is that it's an eyesore and it's just, you know, there's nothing going on there. It needs to go. So I say all of that to say, I wonder if, you know, if something similar happens when these people divert resources and things like that away from cities. And because what I'm saying is gentrification is not voodoo. It's not magic. There's something very purposeful that happens where you have cities that have had, you know, like Compton, for example, or like these other cities where you have these large black and brown populations and, you know, nothing can happen there. There's no businesses. There's no revenue. There's very little of anything. And then all of a sudden gentrification happens and all of a sudden, you know, like magic, resources are there. You know, so I was just, well, go ahead. I don't mean to run on, but.
No, I mean, I think that happens. This radical famous geographer, Neil Smith, called it the seesaw of capital. And essentially, I think that's what you're talking about is like what happened is all of the capital, all of the money was purposefully vacuumed out of cities and put into suburbs and given to white middle class families. Conversely, mostly black families, but Hispanic families and other poor families were trapped in cities and purposefully had money and mortgages and everything else withheld from them. And you keep that program going for decades after decade, and then all of a sudden, all the real estate in those cities is now cheap, and you can go in, vacuum it up, and quote unquote reinvest and kind of double your profit. So that's how gentrification works on like a kind of macroeconomic scale. But yeah, I mean, talking about that school thing, I think it also happens on that more micro scale too. Like in New York, you know, everyone heard about the era of the Bronx is burning, right? No one talks about why that is. It's because they purposefully closed fire stations. Strategic neighborhoods in order to force residents out of those neighborhoods so that they would stop being a tax burden, essentially. And then once that happened, then they could go in, snap up all the real estate and redevelop it for richer people. So that kind of shit is happening everywhere. Same thing that happened in New Orleans after Katrina, where they used the opportunity to bulldoze every public housing project and to close down every public school and turn them into charter schools and to, you know, do all these other things that they were saying, oh, well, we just don't have the money to do this anymore. But now all of a sudden, New Orleans has more money than ever and fewer black residents than ever.
All of a sudden, like magic.
And so that's, I mean, I think what was surprising to me writing the book was just like how blatant it is, you know, like, you know, if you read the New York Times or if you read your local paper or whatever, you're never going to see like what's actually really going on. But it's all written down. It's all there. This has been the plan for years and years, is to push people out of the city and bring in new people.
I was going to say, you have notes in the back of the book that show where to find this stuff. So it's not like you're doing some kind of conspiratorial craziness. It's all right there and you can double check it, even on websites. But what I found interesting, and I don't know if you guys have found similar when reading about gentrification, there's a lot of narratives out there that leave out this stuff. Like this Bronx is Burning type of books out there that talk, make it seem like, okay, everything was overrun with crime. And the most they might say is social services were cut. That's about as much as they go into saying why things were bad. And then this kind of make it seem like this neoliberal fairy tale where, for example, here's one example, but the book Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell just makes it seem like New York was just kind of a cesspool. Rudy Giuliani and some other people come along and say, hey, this isn't broken windows. And then the bad guys get swept off the street. Capital comes back in the city. The city becomes safer. But like you said, the city becomes safer really just means the people that we were underserving, we just kicked them out. Now we don't have to do anything for them anymore. But that's not what this story says. This story makes it seem like a fairy tale, but the Cinderella fairy tale is New York, and the winning Prince Charming is just, you know, corporations and money, and Times Square becoming a Disneyfied theme park is the win. That's the end of the fairy tale. And same with these Richard Florida books. I remember all this stuff about Richard Florida and stuff. And do you think, like, why do you think those narratives prosper as opposed to what you describe, which is easily found stuff that really shows how longstanding and nefarious the plan is? Like, is it a matter of people being lazy or people into the myths, so they sincerely believe it? Or is it, in your mind, conscious deception? Like, people want to spread this myth that they actually know is not true? Like, If you had to speculate, why would you think there are not more books like yours?
I think it's all of the above. Like, if you look at Richard Florida, who, in case you don't know, wrote this book, The Rise of the Creative Class, in the early 1990s. And that became a kind of manual for how cities should gentrify themselves, like tax breaks for tech companies and opening art galleries and hip restaurants to attract people and all that kind of stuff. From my perspective, Richard Florida is a successful scam artist. He gets paid hundreds of thousands of dollars from cities every year to come and consult and say, you know, this is how you fix your city. You do, you know, you essentially follow this same rubric of opening little galleries and giving tax breaks and yada yada.
And coffee shops and make sure that, and he can get really technical sometimes, because I read one of his reports, right? Guys, so you understand who he is. He gives people like blueprints. He gives cities blueprints on how to turn your city into a gentrified, hipsterized city.
Well, that happened.
He's a scammer in the sense that, like, if you look into his data, like, he would say the more creatives you have in your city, the better your city is. But he was including in that, like, hairdressers, baristas, i.e., you know, people who work at Starbucks, anything that wasn't like plumbers, basically, you know. And so he was saying, look, if you have lots of these people, like, then your city will be doing great. But then on the flip side, he wasn't supporting your local, you know, black owned hairdressing business. He was saying you need to bring in, you know, white hipster coffee shops and things like that. So I think he's an academic fraud, to be quite blunt. But yeah,
one of the things that I noticed here in Portland is something that Mario just said, what they did with the schools.
It always starts in the schools, man.
Absolutely. because one of the things, if you know, unless in, if you don't live in the neighborhood and the school's closed, you can't live there because your kids can't go to school. So when they started gentrifying here in Portland, probably about 2000, I mean, I seen the plans for gentrification in Portland. They set them back in 94, but they didn't really start, you didn't start noticing it till like about 2008. And one of the things that they did was they started shutting down schools and combining schools. So here, and it's probably like this in a lot of cities, you have elementary K through five, then you got middle school 6 through 8, then high school. What they started doing was making to where the schools were K through eight. So when the schools are K through eight, now you got who knows how many kids in one school. And then they would shut down the other schools, and they strategically shut down certain schools in certain neighborhoods. And a lot of people were getting pissed off about it because if I live here, but if my kid, if there's no school in my area, I have to move, you know? But the funny thing about it was when the people moved here that weren't from here, they didn't make them go to the schools in the neighborhood. They gave them the option to go to a charter school, different school, wherever they wanted to go. So I thought that was hilarious. Now, here we are, 2019. They're opening those schools that they shut down. They're opening them back up now. And they're going right back to the original model of K through 5, 6 through 8, 9 through 12.
And now the people who moved out of the city, the people who
are gone.
Took their children out of those schools and put them in the charter schools, they can't come back now.
Well, I was telling PE off air, I was saying, you know, when black people get gentrified out of Portland, they leave Oregon, because outside of Portland, where the hell are you going to live? In the country, you know? So
yeah, I mean, I think that's basically the model. I mean, part of the book talks about Detroit. If you look at Detroit, it's kind of, I mean, both Detroit and New Orleans are like two really obvious examples of how this is done. But so in Detroit in 2012, after their bankruptcy, the city literally came up with that exact plan that you were just mentioning, but they made it even more obvious than usual. They said, we're literally going to cut off essentially 80% of the city from all city services, and force people to either move out or relocate to downtown, cut off all the schools, cut off all the streetlights and all of that. Obviously, that plan didn't go through because everyone was like, no, what the fuck are you talking about? But they basically ended up doing it in a more subtle way where, you know, for many years, the outer sections of Detroit didn't have schools, they didn't have streetlights, they didn't have garbage collection. And it forced people to, if they could afford it, move into the newly revamped downtown section of Detroit, or more commonly just move out of Detroit completely. Mm-hmm. The same thing is true in New Orleans too. It's, you know, after Katrina, they bulldozed all the public housing, they closed down all the public schools. FEMA was found to systematically give white families more money to rebuild than black families. I even talked to one person who's black who tried to come back to New Orleans, and FEMA literally told her, we're not going to give you any of your emergency money until you say you're not coming back to New Orleans, until you agree to stay in Atlanta where she had fled to.
Wow.
Those kinds of stories are pretty common. So yeah, it's, you know, when you start putting all these things together, it does sound like a conspiracy theory, like all these people controlling a city and trying to kick out an entire population. But when you look at the facts, it's just what's happening.
This is why, like, when I hear revolutionaries and communists and all these different people talk about dragging bankers into the fucking streets and shooting them in the back, it's because of shit like this. Not saying that, but dude, that is, you know how fucking evil that is, man? Like to sit there and plan shit like that, to purposely deprive people of resources. Do you see the school situation in Detroit? There was one school where it was so deprivated that they didn't even, there were mushrooms growing in the classroom because there was so much fungus and mildew. They had mushrooms literally growing in the corner of the classroom. But then, you know, these fucking bootstrap people will say, well, how come they didn't put money into it and clean the school up? That kind of shit right there, man. And it really pisses me off because I'm so close to it and I see it happening in real time. I see how they start this shit. And it always starts with schools. And then it spread. Like, if you want to know what's going to happen in your city, your school system is always a microcosm of either the direction your city is going in or where your city is already at. And to do that to children, man, is just
But something else I'll say too, it starts with, and this is another way of saying the same thing. I think it's really the same thing that I'm saying. I think, at least in New York, it starts with the kids. And what I mean by that is, like, before you even get to the schools, like, I've lived through several, like, waves of gentrification, because people think gentrification is just one giant process. But in the early 2000s, there was, like, one wave of gentrification, right? And it would be, like, art students, some queer kids, and some different types of, kids, like, maybe people of color who just had a little more money than, say, maybe people of color who were poor. You know, like, that was, like, the first wave, art students, stuff like that. Then they got like a higher level of people because now the neighborhood got a little safer. And then you had like now basically like models and yuppies and celebrities will be coming into your neighborhood. Like Olivia Wilde and Jason Sudeikis live around the corner from me now. You know, they're moving into Clinton Hill. But what I remember, right, was the first wave that moved in were really cool because they were like art students, partiers, queer kids, different types of club kids. You know, they'd make friends with like the people hang out in the stoop. They would know the local drug dealers. They would maybe party with you, do whatever. Then some people who were a little bit better off moved in, you know. Everything was fun. They were kind of like enjoying the slumming, some of them. Like, you know, they weren't as cool as the first group who were generally like having fun or making the best out of, you know, living there. You know, these people had a little more money. They might enjoy like slumming a little bit. The next group moves in and they want their own businesses. Like, you know, they come in, but they don't want to go to like the black restaurant. They want like a white cafe to open up. Until that happens, they're going to try to do everything they can outside of the neighborhood, outside of sleep. You know what I mean? That's the group, right, that will have kids. What I noticed is no matter which group you were in, right, once you reach the point where you were having kids, all this shit that was acceptable slumming from before now was not cool. Like suddenly the people who were on the corner that, you know, they were thinking, oh, they give the neighborhood flavor, suddenly they're getting cops called on them. Suddenly like they want the schools to look like something different. Like to me, when those gentrifiers start having kids, that's when the schools really start getting pressured. Like, okay, we don't want our kids to go to school with your kid.
Absolutely.
And now that we have kids, now we're really going
to change. You're cool how to we hang out behave. With and have a drink at the bar and kick it and talk shit. But when it comes down to the serious business, you know, my kids got to go to school with your kids. Oh, no. We can't have that. That's the same thing that happened here in Portland. Woodlawn Elementary School was all black. You know what I mean? Fabian Elementary School is all black. They use Fabian Elementary School as a testing ground for, there's a college right behind it called Concordia College. And what they did was they had this program called 3 to PhD. So what they were trying to do is take kids as young as 3 years old and get them involved in the STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, things like that, and get them immersed into it. But the plan was, because Portland is so gentrified now, yeah, you're in the program now, but in 5 to 6 years, we know you're not going to be here. And then this program will be ours.
And yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things to that, like one, just in terms of like the phases that T, you were talking about, like that, you know, gentrification, because it's such a planned process, is such a predictable process that back in the 1970s, this researcher, Philip Clay, like literally outlined those stages. Stage one, the artists and the hippies and, you know, the queer kids move in. Stage two, the yuppies move in. And then stage three and four is when like the corporate side of things kick in you know, banks and real estate developers take over everything. So that's how it's happened everywhere. I think now cities are so unaffordable that the stage one and two don't even happen anymore. They just go straight to three and four where corporations own everything.
Yep. I agree with that. I think Detroit had a lot of that happen. Like the Detroit just corporations, banks just came in and just like, you know, reclaimed everything. And then
and the hard part about it is, you know, it's almost like gentrification is almost like a boxing. It's like boxing gets against someone with three arms in 15-minute rounds. You'll never be able to outlast it. It won't happen. You won't make it. They will exhaust all of your resources. And there's nothing.
Three arms.
In 15 minute rounds. The 15-minute rounds is the best.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's like a under-discussed part of not only gentrification, but housing in general is like the way that it's used as a political oppression tool. Like if you look at even going back to the creation of the suburbs and the flip side of that, which is redlining, like the creation of the suburbs happened when there was lots of like working class solidarity happening in cities, when women were demanding more political power and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, the U.S. created a system in which people were forced to be in these individual houses where there was no public space, where you had to work to pay off your mortgage and all of that. So it was this political program where, you know, it's not only about segregating people, it's about changing the way you have to operate in your life. And I think gentrification is the same thing too. It's like, if you have to now, you know, you look at San Francisco or New York or wherever, where all these cool radical movements came out of, where all these cool arts movements and music movements came out of, how the hell are you going to be an artist if you have to work 80 hours a week to be able to afford rent? How are you going to go to your local activist meeting if you're working all the time? So I think it's not, as you said.
It's totally true. When are you going to write? When are you going to have a performance space and rehearse with your band?
Well, that's where's your band going to play? All this stuff is revolving doors. So here in Portland on Alberta Street, Mississippi, all these little cool shops, they only last about 2-3 years and the people are getting the fuck out of here because the rent is not going to stop going up and they're not making enough money. So it's a revolving door of businesses. You know, the only thing that'll stay here is the bars because people like to drink, you know? So the bars will be there, but all these little shops where people are selling figurines and all this other little hipster shit, man, they're out of business in 2 years.
And something else that happens too, what PE was saying, right, about how they're skipping stage 1 and 2 and going straight to stage 3 and 4, the corporations buying everything. One thing I noticed they're doing, right, because I think there's now this global monoculture, right, where I noticed now, like, I'll go on vacation, I'll go to Chicago, I'll go to San Francisco, I'll go to Oakland, I'll go to different parts of the country, even like small parts, and look at places to eat or something to do, and I'll always find a bar that looks like it came straight out of Brooklyn.
Yep.
And it's like, I feel like I've been there without ever having been there. And they'll have mason jars. They'll have Chipotle ancho chili, dry rub wings with...
Same thing here.
Wood all over the bar.
So New York is the culprit. They got that. Yeah.
12 micro. Or maybe, I think it's a combination. I think the food culture came from Portland and Brooklyn brought some other part, but it's all a one giant culture now because now Brooklyn has Portland. Because somebody explained to me that the food part of hipsterism came from the Portland gentrification, but the New York Brooklyn gentrification had a lot of the other trappings. But now there is no really regional hipsterism anymore. It's all just one giant hipster monoculture that is everywhere. But what I notice now is like even places that skip stages 1 and 2, they'll stage phases 1 or 2. Like they'll have some kind of fake hipstery food hall, which is basically like food court in a mall, but hipsterized, and it's not organic at all. Like Detroit was having these ads where they were trying to attract hipsters from New York to move to Detroit. And it's like, they just kind of want to create a look. And I think that's what Richard Florida was doing. He was telling people like it's not, we know it's not enough to gentrify, but you want your city to look cool. So here's how you get people who look like this. Like, make sure you have some fixed gear bike stores around and make sure you have bike lanes and make sure you have enough cafes and you want people. And somebody once sent me one of the reports that his consulting company does. Like, this is not his book, but one of the reports that his company will make for you. He's like, you gotta see this shit. And I look, and it looks like such a caricature of hipsterness. Like, JCPenney catalog has like pictures of stuff and people dressed a certain way. Like, this thing looks like a catalog. And on each page, you know, with having the proposals, there's a guy with like a beard and a knit hat and a lumberjack shirt and, you know, drinking the kombucha. And it's like, oh my God, this is such a easily to replicate, almost self-parody now, you know? And corporations are just faking it now. It's not even organic. They'll make contrived queer spaces, contrived urban spaces that, you know, like, for example, like Biggie Small mural on this block that was commissioned by a real estate group. Things like that, you know?
Yeah, and it's very purposeful. Detroit, I think, is the best example of that. Dan Gilbert, the owner of Quicken Loans, which is, you know, one of the biggest mortgage providers in the US. He bought up something, I think it's now over 90 buildings in downtown Detroit, most of these like multi-story buildings. So he owns so much of downtown Detroit that people now call it Gilbertville. And, you know, he does that exact thing where he brings in the local queer scene or whatever. He brings in the artists, the street artists and all that. He creates music festivals and, you know, and
big graffiti murals.
Yeah, exactly. And to make it seem like all of this is some kind of like organic, organically created culture when really it's just an advertisement for his real estate development. Yeah, it's pretty sad. I mean, and that's why I call it How to Kill a City. I mean, in addition to all the, you know, people just literally having to pack up and leave and the documented health effects that gentrification has on people in terms of stress and in terms of many other things. It's also just like the city itself becomes dead. You know, like when I go back to my old neighborhood, I just feel sad because there's
it's depressing.
There's nothing there. There's nothing. I mean, I can't get a slice of pizza within 10 blocks of my parents' apartment.
Tell them what your old neighborhood is.
Oh yeah, I grew up in the West Village in Manhattan, and like you know, my parents, it was, you know, were some of the, I guess they were like kind of first phase gentrifiers. They bought like a loft for almost no money back in the late 70s, and you know, back when the entire neighborhood was mostly industrial, and because they bought it, you know, they've been able to hang on to it, and now all their neighbors are millionaires. Their kids that live in the building get picked up by you know, a private car service every morning to be whisked off to their private schools. And you know, every store is now like a Marc Jacobs or a Gucci or whatever. And it's just, it's, you know, even if I could afford to live there, which I definitely can't, because I think the average rent is $3,500 for one bedroom now. I wouldn't want to live there because it's just, there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing. It's a shopping mall with like, yeah it's a
shopping mall with high rise apartments surrounding it. That's every city. Like, that's how my hometown is now.
It's kind of weird. The West Village is kind of like a mall slash suburb now. It's so weird because I go to the West Village every weekend. That's where my therapist is. So I go there, and then there's all these little like boutiques that are like high end. Like, you go into them, right? And it's like $1,000 sweaters and stuff like that. Like, I went into one because I was just bored, and I popped in, and I'm like, how much is that sweater? It's like $1,000. And I was like, okay, I'm out. Like, but every place is kind of like that. But this is what I kind of realized is this, and you kind of touched on this in the book, there's not a real continuity anymore. Like, when the old waves of gentrifiers used to come in, there would be enough of the previous people that you had to kind of know what came before you, or people would at least tell you. Now, all these people, and you talk about this in the book, everyone in the neighborhood has varying degrees of being there like 1 to 5 years. So there's like no one to even remember what things used to be. Like, as far as they know, this is what it's always been. They have no idea. Even the stores are all relatively new. So they're not even getting a piece of history in the stores they go to. They're all new hipster cafes or hipster bars or whatever. So it's like, it really is like a dead city. It's like a whole new sterilized city, but none of these people are invested in the place. A lot of them are going to just move somewhere. They either work all day, or they're gonna move somewhere else in like a couple of years. There's, you know, it's.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, yeah, like growing up in the village, like, as I said, my parents in some ways were those first wave gentrifiers, but at the same time, I was connected to that neighborhood. They were connected to that neighborhood. I went to the local public school. My parents lived right on the West Side Highway, which back then, like as a queer kid growing up, was very instructive because I would see all the gay guys like sucking each other's dicks across the street and all the, you know, all that kind of stuff, which, like, you know, now people are like scared of. But to me, growing up as a kid was like informative. Was it influenced me, it made me who I am in a way to be in that kind of neighborhood. And now,
well it's kind of weird, there are still like queer people there, but even the queerness is gentrified. So it's like, it's a whole different queer culture there now. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard for you guys to understand because you don't know this neighborhood, but now it's like there's no type of edginess to kind of being gay in the area. Everyone there is just like as corporate and neoliberal and square as anybody else. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that's going back to that idea of like gentrification, not only as like a money thing, but as a kind of mental political project. It's like how to make people as boring and as good subjects of the state and capitalism as possible.
and cookie cutter.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Cookie cutter. In my old neighborhood, the first thing I remember them doing was they took away all the neighborhood arcades that were there. you know, all the places where the kids used to congregate. They got rid of all of those. Then they worked on getting rid of the movie theaters that all the kids used to hang out at. And then eventually they got rid of the mall and turned it into like this outdoor type gallery or whatever the hell these things are now. And so when I drive through there now, there's literally, there's nothing there that was there when I was a kid. Like my entire childhood is gone. You know what I mean? And I'm not going to lie. Sometimes that's disheartening, man. It's just like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that's weird for me is like people, me and another guy who lived next door to me, we were talking about how people act like we're the interlopers in the neighborhood, even though we were actually there the longest. They act like, what are you doing here? Do I have to call the cops? And it's like are you serious? Like, you know, it's, they have no desire to fit into the existing ethos or whatever of the neighborhood. Like, you know, the people who are playing dominoes in the street bother them. The bar that was on the first floor, they moved above the bar. The bar was there before they were there. You know, it's getting on their nerves and it's keeping their kid from doing their violin or cello lessons. It's just like really like weird. Your book covers four cities. It was in 2014, right?
It came out in 2016, actually.
2016. When were you writing it? When did you start it?
I started like thinking of it in 2010, 2011, but I started writing in 2012 and researching in 2012.
Okay, because you cover four cities, New York, Detroit, San Francisco, and New Orleans. What I wanted to know is, like, what made you choose those four cities? And if you had to do a follow-up to this book or an update, are there any particular cities that you would be interested in adding to the list? Because, for example, I noticed like Portland, where Kenny's from, is not discussed. But that seems to be, I mean, there's so many gentrifying cities now. It's hard to even.
I mean, everywhere, you know, is gentrifying. So I chose those cities because they represented those like four phases I was talking about, like Detroit with its bankruptcy in 2012, kind of being like phase one with like the city figuring out, OK, how do we gentrify ourselves? New Orleans 10 years after Katrina being phase two, where it's like 10 years into this gentrification project. How does the city look? San Francisco being phase three, where all these tech companies have moved in and bought up everything. And New York being phase four, where it's like, this is the end of what a city looks like. What is when it's completely gentrified is like, you know, you go to these neighborhoods like the Village, like parts of the Upper West and East Side, where it's not even neighborhoods anymore. It's just places to park real estate capital, you know, totally empty buildings and everything. So that's why I chose those four cities. I do think I would include Portland, or maybe Seattle or both if I wanted to do this again, just because I think gentrification has spread so fast there recently. But I think I'd also want to include like a lot smaller cities that don't get talked about as much, like, because I think this the same kind of model is now being applied to Cleveland, to Pittsburgh, to like literally every single city in the US, where governments are now saying, okay, we want to follow New York success, we want to follow Portland success, because, you know, I mean, people who run the cities, they see these things as success stories because the cities have more money, they have, you know, less crime and all of that. So I'd want to cover how it's working on this really micro level too.
You know, what happened to the people who left the city and the outskirts and where those people are living now, you know, some of the cities that.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
I'd love to see that as well.
Yeah. I cover that a little bit in the San Francisco section, but I think one of the really hard things about gentrification is like
tracking them down.
Like, how do you find out who's left? And, you know, a lot of research on gentrification from like more liberal pro gentrification researchers will say, oh, well, actually, gentrification is not nearly as big of a problem as people think it is, even though that flies in the face of everyone's lived experience, because you walk down your block and you can see how big of a problem it is. But because it's really hard to quantify, like, if, you know, I can't afford to live in any of Manhattan anymore, but I didn't get evicted, am I a displaced person because of that? If people go off to college or move for a job or whatever, or move down south because they can't afford to live in Portland or wherever, if they weren't, you know, if there wasn't literally a note saying you're not allowed to live here anymore, do they count as a displaced person? And how do you find those people? So I think that is a lot harder of a story, but it's really interesting. I mean, now these stats are, I think when the 2020 census happens, we'll see just how huge of a shift it's actually been. But like, there are stats now that poverty is rising faster in the suburbs than in urban areas for the first time in American history. And, you know, if you go, you hear these stories about like these ICE raids in like Mississippi and Tennessee and shit. And that's because that's where all the immigrants are going, are to these kind of out of the way locations where there's still affordable housing. So yeah, I think that's something that is really undercovered, is how it's not just people being kicked out of cities, but like people just moving to cities anymore.
And one thing I think too is, I think it's worse to be poor, I mean, for the culture, I think it's worse to be poor in a suburb than it is to be in a city. Because one thing I remember growing up in New York, like, and you can see in the old movies, like She's Gotta Have It, you can see what like Fulton Mall looked like then in the 80s and stuff. And it's like, even if you were poor in Brooklyn, I mean, you're still a hop, skip, and a jump away from Manhattan. There's still like places to work, even if it's menial labor. You still have a sense of community, of, you know, people you could be around. And that kind of poor, concentrated urban center, even though it had its crime, its crack, its decay, it also had culture. Like hip hop was able to form in that. But in that poor exurb or suburb, you know, where everyone's spread out, you don't know anybody, you have like drugs on your lawn and you're scared of your neighbors and whatever, like you would never get like an organic scene like hip hop or jazz or funk or any type of culture that would pop out of that. It's just sprawl, poverty and alienation. So it's like the center where the city is, where the transportation, where the buildings, where the jobs are, is now sterile. It's rich and sterile. And the poor people are just spread out and displaced and just in these suburbs. So it's kind of like, I feel like there's no real place for any culture. Like everything is cultureless now. It's just more room for this global monoculture to happen. And the last thing I was going to say, and I was going to let you guys ask anything you had to ask. Did you guys see the show? You said Cleveland. Do you guys remember LeBron James reality show called Cleveland Hustles? Did any of you see that? It only lasted one season, but it was on CNBC, and it was called Cleveland Hustles. And it was basically LeBron James and his business partner. The fact it was on CNBC gives you your first clue. But it says LeBron James launches new reality TV show Cleveland Hustles. This is a description of it from the press release. It's gives four aspiring local entrepreneurs the chance to realize their own dreams while also helping to revitalize a neighborhood in Cleveland. And the word revitalize is like a big sign. Like, okay, what does revitalize mean? And I only saw like one episode of it, but I just got disgusted. It was just all like kind of like artisanal donut stuff and that type of stuff. And I was just thinking, oh my God, LeBron, you have all this money, you have all this stuff, and you just made a gentrification reality show. And
I just want to know what the hell an artisanal donut is. What the hell is that?
I don't know what artisanal anything is. Artisanal just basically is supposed to mean handmade, you know, but I mean, yeah, okay. Yeah, basically. It's meant to be, artisanal means like, it's not even a popular buzzword like it used to be. Like you know, they always have new things like fair trade, free range, but artisanal was big for a while, and it basically means it wasn't made with a machine. It was made by hand, and that gives us an excuse to charge, like you said, three times for it, you know? And Jay-Z would gentrify your own hood. Like, I feel like everyone's just kind of on board with this thing. Even a lot of Black people have cultural capital. You know, instead of using their cultural capital to fight this, they're just jumping on board and promoting the same aesthetic, whether it's LeBron James or Jay-Z. It's kind of being bought into as this accepted good. You know, there's no need to challenge it. It's an unchallenged premise.
Yeah, and I think that goes to like something bigger that's not only about gentrification, but just like the kind of limits of our political imagination now, where we've kind of, you know, decided that like all growth is good, all profit making is good, like all business is good. You know, like we can't even conceive of an alternative reality that different, that is, you know, that somehow provides more for people and is just more interesting than what we have now. And I think that's not only with gentrification, that's with kind of everything.
Do you guys have any other questions?
I think I'd be remiss if we didn't bring up the politician's role in all of this stuff. Because if you look at gentrification in the areas that you name, most of these are Democratic strongholds. And, you know, the Democrats have been able to get away with portraying themselves as the party of the little guy for a long time. And yet we have this contradiction. So what if any role do they play in how this stuff goes down, and how do they skirt by on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Democrats are part and parcel of the gentrification machine for the most part, or really for the whole part. Like, I haven't seen any Democrat really challenge the system. I think there's a couple of things. Like, one, as I was saying, like, we've all decided that base values of like economic growth and, you know, promoting business and all of that, that's good no matter what, and that there's no escaping that. There's, you know, if you're anywhere to the left of that, then you're considered a radical. So all these Democrats, they're Democrats, but they're not leftists. They're not people who are going to challenge the philosophy of capitalism. And also, as I said before, if you're running a city, gentrification looks good. I mean, if you look at your balance sheet, you now have a richer city. You have a city that needs less public services. You have a city where you don't need to house as many people in public housing or provide as much public transit. It's easy. It makes politicians' jobs actually easier to a certain point, because you simply don't have as many quote unquote problems as you used to. But the other thing is just how politics is funded. I mean, look at Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, who literally won his election based on, quote unquote, ending the tale of two cities. He was like the anti-gentrification candidate, and he's completely bankrolled by the real estate industry. So I think that I think you can see that in every American city right now, is that, you know, there's no way out of this system, because the system that promotes it is also the system that funds the supposed opposition to it.
Something I noticed too, that's a tactic they use. I think they use superficial diversity to help. So it's like, okay, this is going to be a place for millionaires and upper middle class people. But what is the population of America? What, it's 13% black? It's this percent queer? Well, hey, we're going to make sure 13% of the millionaires are black, and this percentage of the millionaires are queer and whatever. And, you know, we'll have these like spaces that are superficially celebrating diversity, but it'll be like, you know, $20 jerk chickens. And, you know, like this place by me was having this gay day party. And at the gay day party, the people throwing it were the makers of this product called gay beer. It was literally called gay beer. And beer is doing like gangbusters. You know, it's a huge business. But it's like, okay, this neighborhood is totally gentrified. Everyone at this party is, you know, rich. It's just total like capitalism gentrification. But it's a gay party. So because it's a gay party, it's considered like, you know, progress, whatever, even though everyone there is still contributing to the gentrification thing. And the same thing happens with a lot of kind of bougie black spaces that open up. There's like a black bar and restaurant that's by me, where the people who own it are like pretty rich. The guy was dating a reality star who owned the place and is kind of a celebrity in his own right. It checks off a box for diversity. And I think that's another thing they do in addition to what you were talking about, is that superficial, you know, let's diversify the rich gentrifiers.
Well, they'll make conservatives proud.
Yep.
Democrats would make conservatives very proud, man. That's
same here.
Can I add one thing? On the solutions side of things, I think we have to stop relying on those like local Democratic politicians completely, because they've proven over and over again that they are pro gentrification, essentially. And like, we have to start thinking about like national policies. And I think one of the problems with America, and I think this is like a purposeful thing, is that we never think of housing politically. We're taught, you know, you save and you get to afford a house, and that's the American dream and whatever. And so the idea of housing being like political, it being a human right, it's not ever really part of a political platform here. I mean, even, you know, Bernie Sanders, for example, has a housing platform, but When was housing ever mentioned at a recent political debate? Never. We're never even thinking about it as a political thing, even though it's everyone's number one expense and everyone is being priced out of their neighborhood now.
And the one guy who did make it a major platform was basically a joke. The rent is too damn high guy. Yeah, that's basically, it's Bernie Sanders and that guy. And one of them, and one of them was just a punchline. It wasn't even taken seriously, even though it should have been something that everybody was talking about.
Right, exactly. So I think we have a lot of work to do. I get a little optimistic when I look at like places like Berlin, where they are thinking of nationalizing corporate housing and making it public, where they put a moratorium on development on a bunch of housing. I think things are moving in the right direction in some places, but yeah, I think we're still relying on the same old politics and just like assuming that this is some natural progression that will eventually stop, when in reality it's like connected to everything. It's connected to police, it's connected to capitalism, it's connected to feminism, it's everything, you know, like we need to connect housing to all of these things and make it a central political issue.
I'm done, unless Ken, did you have any last thoughts? Are you good? Oh, okay, I guess he's good. All right, guys. So, P.E., thanks for joining us. Really enjoyed it. And everyone get both his books, How to Kill a City and The Case Against Free Speech. Both are very relevant to today.
Are they available on Amazon?
Yep, they're on Amazon and everywhere else you buy books.
All right, I'm getting ready to snatch up a copy right now. I'm heading there right now.
Oh, also, the way they're written, even though they're full of information, they're very written in a conversational, easy breezy way. Like, so they make good audiobooks too. Because I've read them once and then I listened on get an audiobook just
oh,
to
they got it on,
refresh it.
They have it on Audible?
Have it on
Audible or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay,
so yeah. I did it both ways. And yeah, it's just very good. And so thanks again. And we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. See ya.
All right. Bye.